Okay, hello everybody. This is Karen Dolan and Through the Keyhole, and you're listening to us live on ParanormalRadioNetwork.com. And welcome back everybody to our live shows. I want to thank everyone who stuck with us through a couple of weeks of repeats. Rich and I were out of town. Last week we had some technical difficulties. This week we are back, and we've got Nick Redburn here to talk about his newest book called Memoirs of a Monster Hunter. Nick, you still there?
No, I'm still there, Karen.
Okay, good. I got a little nervous about all the technical stuff going on. So for Halloween, I was kind of hoping to do some kind of scary ghost kind of thing, and so we have monsters we're talking about today.
I guess
this
that's close
enough. Now, Nick, I read your first book, but the prequel to this one, Three Men Chasing Monsters, in which you described your travels across the UK looking for various cryptozoological beasts. And it was a great read. I really enjoyed it.
Thanks.
I have not had a chance to look at your book yet, so can you tell us something about this one?
Yeah, basically, Karen, this one continues from where Three Men Seeking Monsters finished when I moved to the US in the summer of 2001. And it basically covers the period from that time, the summer of 2001, through to the summer of 2006. So it's like a five-year trek around the US and Puerto Rico, kind of like a road trip style, investigating everything from Bigfoot to lake monsters, the chupacabras, werewolf reports, sea serpents, anything that's sort of like a vaguely weird creature, shall we say. And it's all, as I said, first-person, personal investigations and interviews, and you know, just trying to get to the bottom of some of these mysteries.
So there really are reports of things like werewolves. I mean, I've heard about chupacabras, but werewolves, to me, are still in the movie.
Yeah, I mean, that is the thing. I mean, when people talk about werewolf sightings, there's always this temptation, which is inevitable, you know, to think of the classic Hollywood imagery of, you know, the guy sprouting fangs, hair, etc., at the sight of the full moon. If you look back into the history and folklore of werewolves, which is actually quite prevalent in England and Europe, and you go back, say, 500-600 years, when people were talking about werewolves in those days, the creatures themselves actually looked like very large, aggressive wolves. You know, it wasn't a case of people bursting out of their clothes like the Incredible Hulk or something like that. And if you look at a lot of the reports today that we get, they seem to fall into two categories. One is that we still have a lot of reports and sightings of very, very large wolf-like creatures in particularly some of the more remote forested areas of the US. And, you know, I'm talking about something that looks like a wolf, but in some people, you know, some cases people have described it as being a huge animal. Now, it is a fact that prior to their extinction thousands of years ago, there actually were several types of very, very large wolves that walked the United States, huge creatures, you know, almost like the size of a saber-toothed tiger. And one of the theories is that perhaps some of these creatures, you know, in certain pockets, isolated pockets of woodland and forest, which are particularly dense, you know, they may have survived where the landscape and perhaps the temperature and the surroundings haven't changed that much over the years, and, you know, they've skillfully avoided detection, and that may account for some of the reports. But there are far stranger ones as well, a lot of which in England, interestingly enough, occur near old stone circles, and in America occur near Native American burial grounds. And one of the theories that's been put forward is that at least some of things, in simplistic terms, are paranormal, in the sense, you know, they're not purely flesh and blood animals. Now, of course, you know, how we define what the paranormal is, that's a, you know, a completely different matter. But I think with some of these creatures, when you begin to see them or hear accounts of them, and they're all in areas of historical or archaeological significance, and or they seem to have some magical quality to them that ancient man recognized, then I think we have to look a little bit broader beyond just, you know, the idea of extinct animals that have survived extinction or animals that science hasn't classified properly. But, you know, that's one of the things with cryptozoology. A lot of people think it's all just a search for unknown animals, but really it can be split into several different categories. There are those creatures, I'm sure, out there that science hasn't classified. Some reports of cryptids, as they're known, I'm pretty sure are animals that have survived extinction. some may be just things we haven't even classified. And, you know, then, we, as I said, we have this weird category, which, you know, I put things like the Mothman in this category as well, these sort of spectral, almost, type creatures that seem to straddle and parallel other fields like ufology too. You know, for example, various people have said, oh, well, the Mothman is just this huge winged creature. But then again, you find the same place and the same time period where that was seen. You had a lot of UFO reports, Men in Black sightings, poltergeist activity in some of the local houses in the area. So, you know, I think this is a category that isn't that popular with a lot of cryptozoologists. You know, they just like to go with the, I guess, the more down-to-earth angle. But, you know, I feel that if these stories are out there, and yes, they're strange, but it still kind of, you know, behooves us to look into them. So.
It sounds like you've read John Keel's book, Mothman Prophecies.
It's one of my favorites.
Right. I love that. And, that, you know, one of the things I really enjoy about that book is, as you mentioned, where you have to pull together different disciplines. You can't say, yeah, well, I'm going to study this as a cryptozoologist, so I'm only interested in the sightings of the creature.
Yeah, that's right.
You have to look at everything that happens.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the things that I think why so many of these events or incidents, perhaps, you know, we don't get to the bottom of it, is because a lot of times mainstream cryptozoologists don't want to touch them because of the UFO angle, and ufologists don't want to handle them because they feel, you know, if they're looking for nuts and bolts UFOs, and to bring Bigfoot or winged creatures in, you know, might affect their credibility from looking at the UFO angle. So I think nobody really knows how to investigate these things, and so, you know, it's left to people who maybe, you know, are interested in both aspects, but neither camp, if you like, really want to get involved in something that spills over into somebody else's area as well, just through, you know, the unease of how they're going to be perceived by peers and colleagues, I think.
It's funny, someone was interviewing Rich not too long ago and asked, you know, aren't you worried about your credibility writing about these UFOs? And he said, I'm a UFO author. I have no credibility. Why would I worry about that? So it's just funny to me. I mean, and I don't mean any disrespect to any ufologist or any cryptozoologist or anything, because I think this is really amazing stuff to be studying. But I think it's so funny when you said, you know, a cryptozoologist is worried about their credibility for looking at UFOs. I mean, also because we're studying the paranormal, and we don't know what's related to what, and we don't know yet which pieces are important.
No, we don't. I think, actually, you know, I'm sure Rich said a lot of that in jest, but it's good that he, you know, has the strength of character to do what he does, and, you know, not really give a damn about what people say, because, you know, he is pursuing a strange subject. And that's the same approach I take.
Yeah.
I take is the fact that, you know, that there are important weird things going on that we need to resolve. And, you know, if we worry about this, we worry about that, what this person's going to say or that person's going to say, no one would ever do anything. So I think, you know, the fact that we are prepared to go out on a limb is good. But, you know, in saying that, there still are certain people who, you know, don't want to touch the, you know, the high strangeness cases or the crossover cases, because, you know, they do sort of offer evidence that what we may think are straightforward nuts and bolts UFOs or flesh and whatever, in actual fact, there's something far stranger.
Now, when you mentioned the Mothman, for example, a lot of people have read John Keel's book, which talked about the incidents in Point Pleasant, West Virginia, in the 1960s. And many people have also seen the movie. But there have been a lot of sightings of a similar creature that's sometimes referred to as the Mothman, sometimes not, all over the world. Is that...
Oh, yeah, that's quite true. I mean, if you look back, not just in 20th century culture, but right back to the Romans, the Greeks...
That far back?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I had no idea.
Oh, yeah. If you look back into pretty much any ancient cultures, they all have stories of strange, large, winged creatures. You know, for example, although it's kind of different, you know, Native American Indians had the Thunderbird. Now, if you go back to England, a lot of reports from centuries ago, you know, people reported sightings of so-called gargoyles, you know, these sort of bat-winged, devil-like creatures. And we get a lot of those reports today. I actually have one in the book from Texas in the 1940s where somebody driving home late at night saw one of these things in the middle of the road, which was very Mothman-like. In England, a friend of mine named John Downs has written extensively about a creature that's become known as the Owl Man, which haunts the woods of a particular part of Cornwall, the county of Cornwall in southwest England. And so a lot of cultures have reports of these creatures. And, you know, again, we could potentially just be looking at different localized names and localized legends to explain a very similar or identical phenomenon that seems to have been with us for years. And when you talk about cryptozoology, there really are sort of four or five archetypes that people see. One is these large winged creatures. Then there's the classic hairy man like the Yeti or the Bigfoot, abominable snowman. Or in China, you have the Yeren. Then you have the lake monsters and sea serpents. Out-of-place mystery big cats, like in England, you get a lot of reports of people. Then, you know, then you have other creatures which sort of vaguely fall into or cross over some of those categories. But those are the main ones that, you know, we find.
How long have you been studying this cryptozoology and related topics, Nick?
Well, actually, my interest goes back to when I was about 5 years old, so that would be about 20 years ago. I'm joking.
Oh, my goodness, I feel so old now.
That was a joke. But yeah,
I know you're a little older than that.
I'm a little older than that. But, yeah, my interest goes back to when I was about 5 years old, and my parents took me to Loch Ness. Oh, we went to Scotland, actually. We had a day at Loch Ness.
And what a thing for a five-year-old to be interested in.
Well, I guess, yeah, I was kind of a little strange little kid.
Most of us listening and on the radio now, on this station at least, have similar stories.
Yeah, I think when
going
all
back
the,
that far.
The other kids at school were reading things like the British equivalents of Nancy Drew and the Hardy Boys. I was reading about Bigfoot and werewolves and demons and things like that.
That's exactly what I was like as a kid, too.
I was a little Damien.
Reading about ghosts and witches and things.
Yeah.
Okay, so you went to Loch Ness, and did your parents tell their little five-year-old Nick about what the monster that was in there?
That's exactly what happened. That my I have sort of a couple of just vague memories of just sort of standing or sitting. I can't even remember now, on the side of the loch on the shore. So my dad had just pulled up, you know, you can walk down, and telling me this story about how people for years had seen this strange long-necked creature in the loch, and nobody knew what it was, and there were rumors it was a still surviving dinosaur, and you know, that kind of got me interested in, I guess, the paranormal or the mysterious in general. And, you know, I was kind of wide-eyed, I suppose, at the time, just looking out at this huge body of water, thinking, wow, you know, is there really a monster in there? And that's really what got my attention and interest. And then from there, you know, I'd read, as I said, books on it and magazine articles. And as I got older into my teen years, I began to subscribe to various magazines on not just cryptozoology, but UFOs and other mysteries I was interested in. And I guess kind of developed it from there. And after finishing school, I worked on a rock music magazine in England called Zero. And so I was trained in journalism. And so then I thought, well, you know, why not try and combine the training I've now got in journalism with the interest in the paranormal and, you know, apply the journalistic techniques to investigating, you know, weird phenomena, and began doing articles and book reviews, that sort of thing, and just took it from there, really. So that was sort of how it all developed.
Wow. So I'm still fixated on this idea of your parents taking you to Loch Ness at that age. I mean, it sounds like you grew up in a household where this kind of interest in the paranormal was really encouraged.
Well, yeah, I mean, my father, for example, he was interested in strange phenomena, I guess. Not, you know, from the perspective of writing about it or even researching about it, but he served in the British Royal Air Force on radar, and in September 52 was involved in two UFO incidents where strange fast-moving objects were tracked on the radar screens at the base he was stationed at the time, which was called RAF Nitishead. And the first thought was, you know, it was the Russians launching a sneak attack, so aircraft were scrambled to intercept whatever these things were. Pilots couldn't get close. This went on for several nights, and eventually everybody was sworn to secrecy. The radar tapes were impounded. And so, you know, my dad, to this day, you know, he still talks about it and, you know, admits that he doesn't know what happened, but something strange did. So, you know, I guess that kind of gave him that appreciation for the idea that, you know, it'd be arrogant for us to believe that we know everything about everything, you know, on any particular subject. And, you know, I think that from his perspective at least, you know, I'm just guessing that may have had some sort of bearing, and he may just want him to see Loch Ness himself, and, you know, I happen to be there too. But, you know, it was interesting, and people say, well, how could something like a surviving dinosaur or perhaps a creature we haven't even classified still live in Loch Ness and not be found? And what a lot of people don't realise is that although Britain, you know, collectively England, Scotland and Wales, it isn't a large country. It's actually smaller than the state of Texas, all three countries combined. The Loch Ness itself, you know, there's still a lot of wilderness in England, and Loch Ness itself is 22 miles long, a mile wide, and it's at its deepest point almost 1,000 feet deep. So it's a huge body of water, and on top of that, the water is literally pitch black. Now, if we're talking about a colony of creatures that have largely derived their oxygen from the water, they're water-breathing animals, it may well be the case that unless, you know, for whatever reason, they just happen to surface to look around, they may never need to, you know, really leave the water, unless, although there are one or two reports of these things being seen on the land.
I was just going to say, there have been reports of people seeing the animals actually, like, walking across the road.
Yeah, there's a few reports sort of late at night of people seeing this lumbering thing near the shore or just crossing from the woods down into the water. And some people have speculated, like certain types of fish, that even if they're water breathers, they may be able to leave the water for short periods. Now, if that is the case, though, it may well be that, you know, the chances of one actually dying on the land are very slim. And if they all die in this huge lake, you know, 1,000 feet deep and 22 miles long of pitch black water, the chances of actually finding one would be very slim. You know, and nature being nature, that when these things die and sink to the bottom, you know, the smaller life forms feed on it. You know, that's the natural food chain. So I'm not surprised that we haven't actually caught one of these or got definitive evidence. I think that would be very, very difficult. And also, you know, I don't think we're talking about a colony of hundreds of these creatures. You know, we may be talking about a colony of perhaps 20 or so to have a sustainable colony, you know, without inbreeding, and where it would be a sufficient quantity to continue the colony, but not necessarily sufficient to where, you know, everybody and his brother on the loch sees them day in, day out. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, that's a possibility. And, you know, it may well be if they do surface, it's largely done at night, you know, out of the bustle and hustle of the boats that are up and down the loch all the time. So, you know, that would make sense, I think. You know,
that's when they've been seen outside the water too, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, there are one or two older reports of people seeing the Loch Ness Monster actually basking on the shore. But most of those are very old. And what happened was that the number of sightings actually began to increase in the 1930s. And the reason why that happened is that a new road was built next to Loch Ness. Prior to that, you know, it was just a very small road, and there wasn't really that much traffic going past. And, of course, 20 years or so, 30 years before that, there weren't even cars anyway. So it was around about the early 30s that sightings began to increase with the new road put in. And, you know, then it became an area. For example, Loch Ness joins to the River Ness. So it's actually been a place where there's been a lot of, you know, boats and ships back and forth trading, basically. And that's increased over the years. And although, you know, Loch Ness is still kind of like a mysterious, wild and weird place, it's, you know, hugely busier than it was decades ago. So again, you know, if these creatures are living deep in the loch and, you know, have sonar capabilities, for want of a better term, I think the chances of them surfacing when they're able to tell that, you know, these huge lumbering boats are moving above them is very slim. It may well just be at night that, you know, they come out and do whatever it is they're going to do. And of course, with the best will in the world, unless you've got great night scope equipment and you happen to just focus on the one area of the 22-mile loch at the same time as this thing surfaces, you're not going to see it. So, you know, I hate to say it, that because it sounds defeatist, but I'm being realistic more than anything else. I think we would have to be really lucky to actually get firm evidence. You know, the worst case or best case scenario, depending on your perspective, would be one of these comes out of the water and gets hit by a car or something like that. But it would be a shame and a tragedy to have to prove they exist by finding a dead one. You see what I mean?
Yeah, I know you mentioned about the water being pitch black. Mm. It's unusually murky, isn't it? Isn't there something because of the peat bogs in the area?
Yeah, basically what it is, it's full of peat. you know, a lot of the peat comes down the mountainsides, fills the water up, goes into the water, I should say, and then just, you know, over the centuries, it's just then remained as this black, thick water. And certainly at certain levels, it does kind of clear a little bit. But for the most part, you know, you go down a few feet and you are talking about, you know, being able to see a few inches in front of you, and that's it. And that's one of the reasons why people have suggested, if, you know, if the creature's real, that it may well have some sort of a sonar type capability, you know, in the same way that like a bat does with radar, because, you know, there's simply nothing to see down there for the most part. So that's a possibility, I think, that might explain the lack of too many surface reports. It may just not be a good creature as far as its eyesight's concerned, you know, and it relies on other senses that it, you know, are more inclined to be used in the water.
But it does make sense, because anyone who's studied any kind of animal biology, there are many, many examples of animals. There are fish who live in very deep water where it is dark, and, you know, they get around just fine, but they don't really use their sight. Or there's a species of cave fish that's actually evolved so that it no longer has eyes.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, nature does all sorts of strange things, and, you know, you can well imagine that a creature that... I mean, one of the theories is that it became landlocked at the time of the last ice age. Prior to that, Loch Ness was open to the sea. So if something became landlocked, it may well, you know, as nature sometimes does, adapted to that lifestyle. And certainly what a lot of people don't know is that many of the other small lochs surrounding Loch Ness also have these late monster legends attached to them, and one of the theories is that if these things can come out of the water from time to time, maybe, you know, that a small colony's appeared in one of these other places, like Loch Morar, which is another large, very deep loch, not too far away, and that has its very, very similar legends too. So, you know, there could be pockets of these creatures still surviving in various lakes and lochs across Scotland.
Now, I'm getting a comment from one of our listeners online. He says that tests show Loch Ness doesn't contain sufficient microorganisms to sustain an ecosystem which would allow something this large to survive.
Well, that's one of the questions that's been put forward, you know, whether there are enough fish to sustain such a creature. Now, you know, the one argument is that, no, there isn't, but on the other hand, you know, people have said, well, that doesn't stop the fact that people see the creature.
Right. How many years did we think the coelacanth was extinct?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I would say that a lot of people, you know, don't always think about is that when people talk about the Loch Ness Monster, there's always this inkling or idea to think, oh, it's a surviving dinosaur like a plesiosaur, which happened to be a flesh-eating creature. You know, one of the other theories is that it's not a plesiosaur, and therefore it may not even be a meat-eating creature, in which case, you know, we don't have to look at the local fish population. We need to look at the, you know, the vegetable food, if you like, that's available in the loch as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as I said, a lot of people think, oh, there aren't enough fish, but that's because they automatically make the assumption that it must eat fish. It must be a, you know, a meat-eating creature. That's not necessarily the case. That's just largely born out of the idea that it's a surviving plesiosaur.
But do we have a good idea, or are there people who have studied the loch and have a good idea of what sort of food sources would be there?
Yeah, I mean, there is a salmon population. There's no doubt about that at all. And, you know, the problem with determining the sheer scale or lack of it of the food supply is that there have been differing ideas, if you like, or conclusions on the number of fish that are there, you know, versus those that spawn and come into the lake from the River Ness. You see, the interesting thing is that, as I said, the River Ness and Loch Ness are connected, and actually what happens is often the salmon will come into Loch Ness from the River Ness to spawn. Now, what's interesting is that a lot of the sightings of the Loch Ness Monster have occurred in the part of the loch that is closest to the River Ness. Now, again, one of the arguments that was put forward is that, well, you know, that might explain the reason why the creatures are seen there, is because they know that's where it's rich in salmon at certain times of the year.
Right.
So, you know,
or even in plant life that washes down the river.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you could look at it from different angles, or maybe it's learned to survive on, you know, whatever's in there, whether it be salmon, whether it be the plant life, you know, a combination of the two. It's
I've always been fascinated by the fact that something as large as a whale could survive on very, very tiny animals.
Yeah.
It needs a lot. And the listener is saying there's not enough there.
Yeah.
But
the thing is with the Loch Ness Monster as well, which a lot of people don't necessarily realize, is that, you know, most of the reports that we have, they're not talking about a creature that's 50 or 60 feet long, although that is sometimes the imagery that is portrayed. Most of the reports, people say, well, we saw this thing, you know, and the neck was maybe 3 or 4 feet, and the hump was sort of 6. And it's quite clear when they, you know, you assess the report, we're talking about a creature that's like 12 to 15 feet in length. Certainly there are a few reports of lengthier creatures, but the bulk of the reports, you know, we're not talking about a 30 or 40 foot giant creature, you know, thrashing around in the water. We're talking about something that's maybe 2.5 times the length of a human being, which, you know, isn't that big, really.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it looks strange to see something like that, certainly Loch Ness.
Right.
But it's not, you know, it's not huge. And, you know, other people have suggested the idea it might be maybe an unclassified type of giant eel. Now, giant eels can grow up to sort of 13, 14 feet. But clearly, if we're talking about something that occasionally reaches, you know, the 20, 25 feet, if it's an eel, it's, you know, it's not going to be a conventional type. Now, you know, that might come into play as well, the idea that, or this notion that we're dealing with a plesiosaur, some flesh-eating, you know, marauding monster, may not well be the case. And that could explain, you know, the whys and wherefores as to how this creature feeds or doesn't feed.
Yeah. On that note, we're going to have to take a break for a few minutes. But I want to come back and get into this question of whether it might be a kind of eel again. So, everybody, this is Through the Keyhole on Paranormal Radio Network. I'm your host, Karen Dolan, and my guest today is Nick Redfern. We're talking about his newest book, which is called Memoirs of a Monster Hunter. And at the moment, we're talking about Bigfoot, but we've got lots of other monsters to talk about when we get back, so don't go too far. Thanks. Hi, everybody. Welcome back to Through the Keyhole on the Paranormal Radio Network. I'm your host, Karen Dolan, and my guest today is Nick Redfern, author of many, many books, but most recently he has published The Memoirs of a Monster Hunter. We were talking about some of his investigations into various types of monsters he was looking for, and we got as far as Bigfoot. No, I'm sorry. We talked about Bigfoot, but we were talking about the Loch Ness Monster. I was just reading a comment from one of our listeners that says, monster is such an ugly word. We should really find a euphemism so the creature doesn't get a complex. Something like the Loch Ness fishy but not so fishy thing.
Yeah, I mean, I actually understand, you know, where the writer's coming from on that. You know, the idea of monster, it does kind of evoke, you know, horror film type scenarios. In actual fact, we're just, for the most part, I think, looking for unknown animals. You know, they're not by definition monsters. I think what's probably happened, or what has happened no doubt, is that the, you know, things like the Loch Ness Monster, the name's become romanticized, and particularly for, you know, things like the Scottish Tourist Board, you know, it's a dream come true, you know, because people flock to Loch Ness and buy t-shirts and mugs, and if it was just the Loch Ness cuddly little eel or something, that wouldn't necessarily sound so good.
That would be pretty unique.
It might be more, you know, correct, you know, in literal terms. I don't know, but, you know, I think there's always it's human nature, you know, with an interest in the paranormal and the unexplained to, I guess, look at these things as monsters rather than just, oh, it's an unidentified animal.
Yeah, well, monster makes a better headline.
Exactly, yeah.
Just like the Mothman. Actually, you know what I wanted to ask you about is your expeditions to Puerto Rico, looking for the Chupacabra.
Yeah, I've made several trips to Puerto Rico now, which collectively amount to about 3 weeks to a month on the island. And the Chupacabras, I'm sure all your listeners are familiar at least with what the creature is. It's this, been described variously as sort of like a 4 to 5 foot tall creature with a monkey-like body, but kind of like a classic alien grey head in some respects. Some people have said it has spikes running down the top of its head and down its back. Vicious-looking claws and fangs, and in some cases glowing red eyes. And in other cases even, witnesses have reported the creature supposedly having like a pair of bat-like wings, or as one witness put it, a pair of wings like a pterodactyl, kind of leathery and large and almost transparent in some respects.
So there's a crossover with the Mothman then?
Yeah, exactly. That's just like another case, you know, whereas America has the Mothman, Puerto Rico has this other flying or, you know, winged creature, the Chupacabras. And for the most part, reports of the Chupacabras began to surface in the early 1990s, and Chupacabras is Latin for goat sucker, and it was given this name because a lot of the animals on the island, goats predominantly to start with, were being reported killed by ranchers and farmers, and they described how the bodies had been drained of blood, and there were two classic puncture wounds on the necks of the animal, you know, which created like a vampire imagery almost.
And I'm thinking cattle mutilation.
Yeah, exactly. Very, very similar in some respects. The only major difference being that most of the people who've talked about the Chupacabras attacks have talked about a weird creature, whereas in the U.S., you know, it's largely strange lights in the sky are associated with the cattle mutilations. But one of the things I found when I went out there for the first time was that the reported attacks on the animals, the farm animals, etc., actually didn't begin in the 1990s. What happened was that, for the most part, the media began reporting on it in the 1990s, and then the UFO magazines and paranormal magazines began publishing stories on it, and it developed into like a real phenomenon. But if you go over there and speak to the locals, you know, the ranchers, the farmers, the villagers in some of these little isolated towns and villages on Puerto Rico, you find that they were aware of something very, very similar going back decades. For example, in the 1980s, there were a lot of reports of something that became known as the Moca vampire. And Moca is a part of Puerto Rico, part of the island. And it was given this name because, again, animals were being found drained of blood. And the earliest case that I personally investigated on my first visit to the island was from 1975, when a woman who to this day still lives high in the El Yunque rainforest, this huge rainforest that dominates Puerto Rico. She told me how she was driving home and literally had to bring the car to a halt because this weird creature was stood in front of her. And again, she described it as looking like a monkey, glowing eyes, claws, fangs, and these two huge wings. And she said it kind of opened the wings up wide in what she perceived to be, I guess, a threatening pose. And quite understandably, you know, she didn't get out of the car and she just waited, and she said it kind of shuffled to the side of the road. So, you know, it's when you actually get out there and gain the trust and confidence of the locals, you find that they've been well aware of this for years, but there's a lot of superstition on Puerto Rico and very much a reluctance to talk about these things. So, you know, that's the thing that sort of opened my eyes, is that when you get out there, you begin to realize how much of sort of a phenomenon that dominates the area it is. You know, it's not just something that has just suddenly surfaced out of nowhere in the UFO magazines of the last few years. It's got a long cultural history attached to it as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think most of us have read a lot about the Chupacabras in Fate magazine, UFO magazine. I think they even did an X-Files episode on it, didn't they?
Yes, they did, yeah.
So, you know, a lot of us have heard about it, but it's just this story. It's like the werewolves. You know, you don't think about it being real. That must be such an amazing feeling for you to go and travel these places and speak to people who actually have seen them.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the important thing, is that you have first-hand witnesses. You know, Puerto Rico isn't that big, so I had a researcher on the island on both occasions, and you know, they were able to find people for us to interview, and it was a good wide range, you know, just members of the public, farmers, police officers, and even members of the local civil defense unit that actually go out and investigate these cases. And almost like a quick reaction Ghostbusters type team would be the best way to describe it. Quite literally, you know, they go out and assess the scene and take photographs and collect bodies for autopsy, etc. So when you know, collectively you've got all those different people in different disciplines and areas, you know, you begin to realize how seriously it's taken, and that everybody sort of views the fact that, well, something's going on. Now, you know, I mentioned with the Mothman, for example, how it seems to straddle cryptozoology and the UFO subject. The same thing is in evidence on Puerto Rico with the Chupacabras. we get a lot of reports of chupacabras encounters in the same vicinity as where we get a lot of the Puerto Rican UFO reports, and certainly Puerto Rico has had a wealth of UFO activity over the last 10 to 15 years, perhaps longer than that even. A lot of flying triangle type UFO reports in the same areas where there have been chupacabras attacks. And one of the strangest cases, which I guess is kind of like a perfect example of this, is that in the book, I relate the story when I went out there the second time in 2005 with Paul Kimball, who's a Canadian UFO researcher and filmmaker. And we went out there and we spoke with a rancher who, again, whose animals had been attacked, and he'd gone out in the night and heard all this noise going on in the woods and grass next to his property, didn't know what it was, and found his animals dead. And then a couple of days later, he said a couple of characters came out to his ranch, flashed badges saying they were from some arm of the US government, like a classic man in black and woman in black, questioning him about the experience and what had occurred, etc. And so again, you know, in the same way with the Mothman and John Keel, here we have a strange winged creature with UFOs and then men in black characters coming out trying to find out what was going on from the locals. And, you know, this seems too coincidental to not be paralleled, if you like, or for there not to be a reason why there's a parallel with some of the things that went on at Point Pleasant that Keel talks about in the Mothman prophecies. So, you know, there are people who view the chupacabras as like a giant type of bat, and certainly, you know, in the prehistoric era there were giant bats. There's not huge bats, there's no doubt about that, things that, you know, by definition would be termed monstrous, but on the other hand, that wouldn't explain why we get these sightings in conjunction with UFOs. So, you know, we have to look at all the different aspects and all the different angles, and you know, there are other theories put forward. Quite a large number of people on the island, as I said, it's quite a superstitious location. A lot of people think it's actually connected with the undoubted large amount of occult activity and voodoo worship and things like that that goes on the island. You know, some people think it's literally like a demonic creature that's been summoned up from some, you know, paranormal realm, if you like. So you have, you know, there isn't even, I guess, a consensus on the island as to what the creature may be. I think it depends on the perspective and the belief systems of the relevant person whose life's been affected by it.
Wow. What kind of physical evidence is there?
I mean, well, you mentioned, you know, for the most
mutilated
part,
animals.
I'm sorry, say that last bit again.
You mentioned that there are mutilated animals that,
yes,
apparently have been collected and studied.
Yeah, I mean, when we went out there on the first time particularly, we were shown the bodies of dead chickens, for example, that had been killed by reportedly killed by the chupacabras. And we were able to speak to veterinarians who said, yes, they'd checked the animals out, and yes, there was a significant, you know, amount of blood missing, but the bodies hadn't been torn apart. You know, it wasn't like somebody had, or something had slashed the bodies open and blood had just spurted everywhere. The animal had been killed by a wound to the neck, and a certain amount of blood had gone. It wasn't the case, as some people have said, that the bodies were completely drained of blood. That didn't happen. It was a significant loss of blood.
Now, that is the case in a lot of the cattle mutilations, though.
Yes. Yeah, that's true.
Okay. And but what about the kind of cuts? Were these similar to the cattle mutilation cases in that they're surgical slashes? Or?
Not for the most part. For the most part, all the ones we looked at, I think, were just quite literally two, or in one case, three puncture wounds. Usually on the neck, if it was something like a goat or a farm animal, or, you know, if it's something like a chicken, it was usually on the body. One of the things that one of the civil defense people we interviewed on the first trip told me was that in several of the attacks that they looked into, the liver had been removed, but now that was removed with like a clean cut. So whatever was doing this, you know, it wasn't like a pack of wild dogs or, you know, a fox just going in and just viciously tearing everything apart. One of the farmers I spoke with told me how he bred chickens, and he had like cages of about 20 animals, 20 chickens stored in one in each cage. And they had quite a complex lock on each door. And he said that whatever had killed them had actually opened this complex lock where you had to sort of pull it one way, then lower it, then push it the other way and pick it up to open the cages. And apparently they'd done this on each and every cage, and the animals were dead in the cages, weren't strewn around on the floor. but again, they got the puncture marks and the blood gone. What was interesting about his case and many others, and this does parallel the cattle mutilations, he said that there was, when the events were presumably occurring at the time, the animals weren't making a lot of noise, you know, there was no screaming or anything like that that would be the case if a predator was prowling around. You know, animals go crazy when they feel, you know, they're threatened by being attacked. But there was none of that, and his property, you know, he wasn't that rich, very, very poor, so his little area where he kept all the chickens literally backed onto his back door. And he and his family were sleeping in there, and yet they didn't hear any screaming from the chickens or anything like that. It was just a case the next morning, you know, something had stealthily come in, killed them, drained the bodies and left.
Wow. Now, my mother grew up, her family kept chickens when she was a kid, and she told me once that chickens are noisy. Mm. Anyway, she said, if you ever keep chickens now, you want them not right up next to the house because they are noisy normally.
Yeah, that's the one of the strange things about these chupacabras attacks is it's almost as if, you know, I hesitate to say that they have a means or a way to, you know, anesthetize or knock out their prey. Mm. You know, that's just hypothesizing, but there seems to be some modus operandi, if you like, that allows the chupacabras to kill and drain these creatures of blood without, you know, the animals reacting and screaming and causing a fuss and waking people up.
Is there any physical evidence that looks like the victim, the animal, put up any kind of a fight?
For the most part, you know, there isn't. I mean, it isn't like, as I said, the animals, even, you know, farm animals, there's not real much evidence in terms of them, you know, running away and trying to get away, and where the animals jumped on its back and clawed it as it's, you know, trying to run. It literally is as if something just silently crept up and just grabbed it by the neck and then pulled it to the ground. Now, certainly, you know, big cats, for example, lions, tigers, you know, they, contrary to what a lot of people think, they don't kill unless it's absolutely necessary by tearing the animal apart. They grab the animal, and as soon as they've got a firm hold on it, they move their jaws to the neck, and they, you know, they just press down on the neck to suffocate the animal. And when the animal's dead, then they feed on it. You know, they don't try and rip it apart while it's still alive. It's just too much effort. Yeah. They just, you know, they just kill it and then eat it. So, you know, that seems to be kind of similar to that in the sense that whatever the chupacabras is, it knows enough just to basically disable its prey by going for, you know, I guess the throat where, you know, you're taking oxygen.
Have there ever been any reports of these creatures attacking humans?
Well, I mean, we heard one or two reports, which, you know, I will admit were either friend of a friend of a friend stories, or they were kind of like an apocryphal type story. I specifically asked the civil defense people about this, and, you know, have you ever come across any cases of human mutilations or humans killed in what looks like it could be a chupacabras attack? And the response I got on several occasions was, well, you know, we've heard about one or two of these, but every time we've investigated them, excuse me, it's been, oh, well, you know, so-and-so down the road told me, and then they went and visited this person, he got it from somebody else. There's never been anything sort of substantial in that respect. That doesn't mean, you know, there isn't a basis of truth to some of these stories, certainly, but we were never able to, you know, pinpoint one case where we could go out and somebody said, yes, you know, my relative was killed in a strange, under strange circumstances. That didn't happen, though.
Okay.
But, arguably, if that did happen, you could well understand why it would be those cases that might have the official stamp of secrecy put on them immediately. So, you know, I think the more controversial the case, it's possible the less likely you would hear about it.
Right. And there have been cases of cattle mutilation, well, of attacks on humans, human beings being found.
Oh, yeah, there's
with,
a few in the,
you know,
U.S. that people have talked, and South America people have said, you know, this is the work of whatever's doing the cattle mutilations. And, you know, I think, you know, we have to look at the whole controversy surrounding the chupacabras. You know, although some people do think it's like a giant bat or some sort of unknown creature we haven't classified, how then do we reconcile the fact that we get these weird lights in the sky and flying triangles in the same location? I mean, this makes some people think that, you know, the creature itself is an alien creature. That was something we heard uncountless times, you know, that it was somehow I won't say in simplistic terms like a pet of the aliens or anything like that, but something that had been released onto the island, you know, as a, for whatever purpose, you know, just to see how it reacts or can it survive on our environment, who knows. You know, as I said, other people felt that he had paranormal origins, and I mean, as evidence of this, Chupacabra's reports have been filed all across Puerto Rico, Latin America, Mexico, and John Downs, a friend of mine from England, who I went to Puerto Rico with on the first occasion in 2004, John also went on to Mexico and did some investigations in some little villages and towns there, and when he actually got to one of these villages, all the houses in the village had white crosses painted on their front doors because they were that terrified of whatever had been doing these attacks. Now, that sounds, you know, like something straight out of a classic horror film, you know, a Dracula-type movie.
That does. That's going back to the vampire.
Yeah, exactly. But this was basically just down to the fact that in certain locations, as I said, there's this belief there's a UFO connection. In others, they're just terrified that they're dealing with literally paranormal vampire-type creatures and that the Chupacabras is a manifestation of one of these. So, you know, it's difficult to investigate in terms of knowing what's going on when there are so many different angles and aspects to the puzzle, which is why, you know, in the book I've tried to recount all the different theories that were put to us rather than, you know, try and just focus on one, which might be a biased approach, and, you know, you may well be going in the wrong direction even by doing that anyway. So.
Right, that's why, I mean, this becomes so fascinating because you mentioned the possibility of a voodoo connection. Or
yeah, I mean, that's something that we heard. I forget if I heard that on the second trip, but certainly the first trip, I heard that on many occasions. The idea that, you know, some of these creatures aren't necessarily flesh and blood animals, that there was a, you know, a link with ancient rites and rituals, and they were being summoned up either purposely or inadvertently, and, you know, something had, you know, a doorway had been opened to some occult realm and these things had come through, in simple terms. That was a belief that was ingrained in certain areas and certain little towns and villages on Puerto Rico. One of the other areas that there was deep suspicion around in terms of the locals was the very, very extensive cave systems that exist on Puerto Rico. A lot of people we spoke with would not set foot in many of these caves because they believe that the Chupacabras lives deep in some of these large cave systems. And there's no doubt these caves exist. We went into several of them, and, you know, about as far as we could go. And, you know, when you look at the nature of the attacks, or the locations, I should say, most of the attacks have occurred on farmland, which is down in the lowlands and on the, you know, the lower parts of the island. A lot of the sightings either occur in the El Yunque rainforest, which is, you know, very high up in the mountains and the hills, or they've occurred near the cave systems, which are also higher up in the rainforest. So if this is a flesh and blood creature, you can easily understand its logic of hiding out in the caves and the forest, the rainforest, you know, during the day perhaps, and then traveling down under cover of darkness at night to feed, and then retreating back to the caves and the forest at night. And
oh my God, that is, just that image, the way you described it, is absolutely chilling.
Oh, it is. It's a, you know, it's, I think, again, you, to an extent at least, you know, you need to get out there to appreciate the, and chilling's the right word for it, the chilling nature of what the beast may be or what's actually going on. You know, it's almost like it's some sort of very, very cunning, diabolically intelligent, yet monstrous looking animal. You know, and I think sometimes, maybe it's our bias, we imagine if it looks like a weird creature or a monster, it may not be that intelligent. That might not well be the case. You know, it could be infinitely intelligent, but it just looks like our interpretation of an animal.
But it's intelligent enough to open up that block.
Exactly.
On the chicken cage.
So,
oh my gosh.
Mm.
On that note, we're going to have to take another break.
Okay.
And this one's going to be a bit longer.
Okay.
So everybody, get a chance to go get a cup of coffee, get a glass of water. Don't go away too far, though. Be sure to come back. We've got another hour to talk with Nick about his new book, Memoirs of a Monster Hunter, and we've got lots more monsters that we haven't even touched on yet. So don't go away. Be right back.
Okay, I'll just be a minute, Karen.
Okay, sure.
The way he's speaking, I think it must be, you know, substantially more than that now.
Great. He works so hard putting those together.
Oh, he does. I always find it amazing that, you know, with a theme conference of crashed UFOs, you know, there's still a good diversity of cases and people to come up with, you know,
yeah.
So the audience isn't just sort of, you know, treated to just repeats every year or whatever. You know, he's got a good selection each year of different people.
Just shows you how much there is in the topic. Okay, we're back. This is Through the Keyhole. I'm your host, Karen Dolan, and my guest today is Nick Redfern, author of his most recent work, Memoirs of a Monster Hunter. And we've been talking about his new book and about some of the creatures that Nick has been studying and searching for all over the world. Nick, one question I wanted to ask you that I didn't get to before the break when we were talking about the chupacabras. When you went to Puerto Rico on two separate occasions to find out about these, and you spoke to many people who have seen physical evidence left behind by the creature and who have seen the creature themselves, did you ever see them?
You know, unfortunately, I didn't. I mean, the first occasion we went, we actually did spend a few nights in the locations, I mean, literally through the night, in the locations where some of the attacks had occurred, where there'd been, you know, more than one attack in the same location. You know, to be honest, I thought the chances were pretty slim of us finding something, but then again, I thought if you don't get out there in the field and do it, you're definitely not going to find anything.
Right.
So I think it was two nights we stayed out, you know, and through the night, the early hours, and, you know, we didn't see anything substantial at all, but, you know, I figure that for the most part, you never do. It's just, you know, I'm always been of the approach that, particularly with cryptozoology, it's one of those areas where you have to get out there and investigate. It's one of those, you just cannot really do it from the benefits of the internet.
Right.
So, you know, going out into the field, camping out, you know, staying up through the night, walking the woods or whatever, that's all vital. And yes, the chances of finding something are pretty slim, but, you know, eventually we may just strike lucky. So, you know, I always try and do that where possible.
How much time did you spend out there? How long were each of your trips?
Collectively, I think it was about 23 days, something like that. So, you know, you bear in mind that on an island the size of Puerto Rico, when you have a few researchers helping you and in advance have found people for you to speak with, then that makes the job a lot easier and you can get a lot done in, you know, a few weeks of being on the island. And then John, who I went with, also, he spent another, I think, 2 weeks there, and then 2 weeks in Mexico and Florida where there have been similar attacks. So collectively we were able to put together, you know, a good body of testimony and witness interviews.
So how did you arrange all of this ahead of time? I mean, how, you just mentioned now that you had some other researchers helping you. How did, who found the people to talk to?
Well, what it was that, for example, on the second trip, I went with Paul Kimball from Puerto Rico. I'm sorry, from Canada. I went to Puerto Rico with Paul. And
Paul was
putting together a documentary called Fields of Fear.
Yeah.
And this was basically on the whole animal mutilation mystery, you know, cattle mutilations in Canada and the U.S., and the animal attacks on Puerto Rico. And in this particular case, Paul said, you know, you've been there previously. Do you want to come along and be like, you know, the man on the island and we'll follow, you know, as you go around interviewing these people? And I said, yeah, that sounds good. So what Paul did, I gave him a bunch of contacts and names and places where there'd been attacks, and then Paul found on the internet a local researcher on the island that had looked into all these things, and they planned ahead for us to speak with various people. So that's basically how it happened, and then, you know, I was able to arrive there, and we get driven around to different farms, ranches, and to the people at the Civil Defense Unit. You know, we had specific times to interview the civil defense people, you know, when they were off duty or they had a quiet period. So, you know, it worked out well to not have to get there and think, okay, now what do we do? Where do we go? You know, that we were lucky enough in the sense that that was done for us.
So was this arranged some, I mean, did you have the book all arranged before you went over there? Was this
if we'd spoke to dozens of people and nobody had anything interesting to say, then there'd be nothing to write about.
Right.
Now, what actually happened was that although the book's come out this year, whenever I go on an expedition, you know, I always take tape recorders, notepads with me, cameras, movie cameras, and just try and record as much material as I can. But to ensure that, you know, I don't ever forget anything or omit anything, I always try and write up the report as soon as possible after getting back. So although this, the new book, Memoirs of Monster Hunters, just published last month, September 2007, many of the chapters are actually written immediately in the immediate aftermath of doing the investigation. So, you know, some of the chapters were just, you know, sat on my computer hard drive for a couple of years, or, you know, year, 18 months or whatever, while I was off doing other investigations. And then after 5 years, I had enough material to, you know, put them in chronological order, if you like, and, okay, and make a book out of it. So, that was basically
how
I did.
So is that why so many books, why, well, you've brought out so many books now? Because you've been collecting all of this information.
Yeah, I mean, you know, some authors, for example, you know, have a 9-to-5 job, so they're only able to do a couple hours at night or at weekends. You know, I've been lucky enough that I work from home as a journalist, so, you know, although the UFO subject and paranormal, you know, despite what some people think, that actually isn't my main source of writing. It's just mainstream feature writing. I do a lot for the British Daily Express newspaper and various magazine, just newsstand magazines and newspapers. And this is sort of a side thing. But because I work from home, you know, I can, you know, perhaps do 4 or 5 hours a day, sometimes more, every day of the week. You know, so that allows me to do a lot more writing. And so while it sometimes looks, you know, if I put out, like this year, for example, I had 3 books published this year, Celebrity Secrets, Man Monkey, which is a study of British Bigfoot reports, of which there are quite a few, and the new one, Memoirs of a Monster Hunter. But collectively, I suppose, I was writing all 3 of them over the course of the last few years, and then coincidentally, they all just sort of came together at the same point, really.
So you normally live and work at home in Texas,
yes,
writing for British papers.
Yeah, I do a lot for British magazines and newspapers.
What do you usually write about?
Mainstream news
yeah,
stories.
Do they really want to know in Britain what's going on in Texas?
No, actually, you know, a lot of it is British-based stories, but where the editors, who I've known for years, know that I have, you know, interests or knowledge in those areas. For example, you know, even though I live over here, I've done a lot of stories for children. I do a lot of writing for children's animal magazines. So, you know, it may be an article on, to give you a good example, a monkey that gave birth to a baby spider monkey some months ago. And I did a piece for, an ongoing piece for a children's magazine about how the monkey's mother rejected it, and then the keepers had to bring it up, and they would take it home with them at night and wrap them in a blanket, etc.
Oh.
And this is like an ongoing piece of like 5 or 6 weeks of, you know, what's next in the life of the little monkey. So, you know, a lot of what I do is nothing to do even with the paranormal, never mind just cryptozoology. And I do quite a lot of music-based stories for English magazines and CD reviews and things like that. So.
No, you're really into punk music.
Yeah,
When did, I think you and I met in Aztec in 2003.
That's right, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and Paul Kimball was there too, wasn't he?
That's right. I mean, I've done a lot of, I like Paul because, you know, he's one of these guys, he's a filmmaker, he likes to travel around, go to different locations and, you know, see what's going on and, you know, get his hands dirty, so to speak, in terms of getting out there. And, you know, I think there are a lot of TV documentaries particularly that are quite happy and content to just splice together old footage and have a few head and shoulders interviews done in the studio, whereas Paul's more of, you know, the sort of gung-ho get out there guy. And, you know, that's what I like to do, so that's why I enjoy working with Paul. And we've done, you know, a few TV things and on-location shoots, so, you know, I enjoy doing that. So.
I'm just picturing the two of you going, you know, crashing through Puerto Rico jungle looking for the chupacabra. Oh my! And I can picture the two of you doing it too.
That's pretty much what we did. We had Paul's brother Jim had the driver. We had this big Land Cruiser type thing, and then there was Paul and the researcher that we had, Orlando. He would sit in the front with Jim. Me and Paul would be behind, and then there was the two cameramen and the sound guys, John and Finley, behind us. And we sort of pretty much kept in the same seats the entire week and just cruised around Puerto Rico from location to location.
Oh my gosh. So you didn't have to assemble this whole crew though, right? I mean,
No, this was done by Paul.
Yeah,
I was lucky enough, as I said, that Paul wanted me along to, you know, to be the researcher that they would follow on this aspect of the Fields of Fear documentary.
Okay.
So it was a case of, you know, we want you along, we've got a few people lined up, you know, nobody's really interviewed them before. Would you like to be the interviewer that comes out, the researcher, and we follow you, you know, tracking these people down and speaking to them and getting their views and opinions? So that was pretty much, you know, what it was. It was sort of the, like a fly on the wall camera following me, following the witnesses, so to speak.
Oh, that must have been so much fun.
Oh, it was. We had a good time, and I know that Paul put together, you know, hours and hours of footage, which has never been seen, and I think he's been talking about at some point putting it out there, you know, some of the serious stuff and some of the plain daft and stupid things we got up to as well, and outtakes and things like that. So.
Okay, is there any story that you can tell us about right now, or we're going to have to wait until Paul gets this out?
Well, there wasn't anything too outrageous or over the top, I don't think. It was just, you know, we just had a few light-hearted goofing around moments and things like that. But, I mean, the stories we got, the Chupacabra stories, were very good. I mean, for example, you know, we spoke to people. I mean, Orlando, for example, the researcher who came with us, who lives on the island, Orlando Pla, he was sort of like a fountain of knowledge on the stories. He'd interviewed countless witnesses. He was very well versed in all the different theories that had been put forward for what the Chupacabras might be. We spoke to people at the Civil Defense Department who, you know, had differing views on the subject. You know, one who thought it was the work of dogs, another one we went to see who formerly worked for the Civil Defense Unit and was now retired, and he was firmly of the opinion that it was a real creature, or an unknown creature. So, you know, we were able to get everybody's opinion, if you like, and get a good wide range of, you know, stories, theories, ideas, etc.
So, okay, we have talked a lot about the Chupacabras, and the name means goat sucker.
Yeah, that's correct. Most of the animals that were attacked in the first place were goats, and you know, it just sucked the blood. So I guess it was, you know, an ideal name for it.
Yeah. Well, there's another creature that was mentioned in the blurb that I read about your book, called the Goat Man.
Mm.
And I wanted to hear about that because I have never heard of that one before.
Oh well, that's the Goat Man story. Like a lot of these giant winged creatures, many nations around the world have legends of what have become known as goat men type creatures. For example, if you go back to like ancient Greek legends, you have the stories of the fauns and the satyrs, which are described as like a man-like body or upper half, but with a lower body that looks like a hair-covered, cloven-hoofed creature, if you like. Now, again, most of these reports, you know, tend to fall into the category of folklore, legend, mythology, and today what I guess we would call the paranormal. But if you, you know, if you do sort of an internet search on Goatman plus United States, you find that countless states across the U.S. have their own legends of these vaguely paranormal goatmen-type creatures that have manifested or appeared. And there's one in Maryland, a very famous one in Maryland, the Goatman of Maryland. The one I investigated, purely because it's actually not that far from where we live, was the Goatman of Lake Worth. And Lake Worth is a large lake not too far from Fort Worth. We live in downtown Dallas, so it's like only about a 45-minute drive from where we live. And what happened was that in the late 1960s, there were reports from Lake Worth. And Lake Worth, it's a large lake, and it's surrounded by very, very dense, thick woodland. And there were reports in the 60s of people driving around the lake, and they would see this weird creature sort of lurking in the woods, which there was various descriptions. Some described it as like the classic Goatman imagery I just described. Others said it was more of like a wild man, Bigfoot-type creature. And, of course, as you can imagine, in a little local community, all hell metaphorically broke loose, and, you know, people were out there wandering around with guns at night shooting and anything and everything, which isn't that strange for Texas, I've come to find out. And, you know, the police were out there warning people to keep away before somebody got their head blown off, you know,
oh
by somebody
God.
St- stalk in the woods at night with guns. And a number of reports, high-quality reports, good reports, came in that made their way to the police. And the police actually took the subject very, very seriously. And even today, they have the old records on file from when they went out there and investigated these goat man sightings. People, as I said, described it as sort of a wild man-type character. And the mystery, like a lot of these crypto mysteries do, it ended as mysteriously as it begun, with the sightings just coming to a halt. Although over the years there were a few sporadic reports. Well, in the summer of 2005, I decided to take a trip out there, and I went with two friends of mine, Ken and Laurie Gerard, who live in San Antonio and also investigate and write about crypto mysteries. So we went out there one weekend, and basically to sort of check out the areas where the ghost man had been seen and, you know, get some photographs of the locations. And we interviewed various people, including some of the people who worked at the local sort of wildlife center on the island, to get their views and opinions, etc., etc. And but a lot of the sightings had occurred in the woods around Lake Worth, but all the people we interviewed who said that they'd seen the creature or knew about it said that it lived or lurked, apparently, on this small island on Lake Worth called Greer Island. Now, Greer Island is normally closed to the general public, but it was just purely down to chance and luck that when we went out there, it was open up. It was opened up, and it's connected to the mainland by this small, thin stretch of land, which, as I said, is normally closed, but we were allowed to go over there. And we were walking around the island for probably 30 to 40 minutes, and, you know, it's like a little desolate, small body of land, very, very dense, thick trees. You know, you sort of have to really be careful walking your way around there, snakes and all sorts of things out there. And while we were walking through the trees, we came across this unusual structure. And this particular structure I'll talk about is actually something that's reported surprisingly often in Bigfoot reports, although a lot of people don't know about it. And they become known as Bigfoot teepees in the sense that they're like a tall structure or formation of branches that have been torn off the trees and placed in like a pyramid teepee fashion. And if you, again, if you do a Google search on Bigfoot plus teepee, you'll see a lot of photographs where people have found these pyramid-like structures made out of thick branches that have quite clearly been just torn off the trees and placed into these positions. And some people have said that, you know, if Bigfoot's a real flesh and blood animal, that maybe it creates these formations as kind of like a territorial boundary marker or something like that. Now, as I said, nobody really ever goes out on Greer Island. We were walking around for a long time and just literally stumbled across this thing. Literally about 5 feet away from that, we found, or that we couldn't miss, a large area of flattened ground and the remains of a half-eaten fish. So this was kind of, you know, this was really sort of strange to us, to be in an area where we knew these weird creatures had been seen, and then to find these strange formations that had also been associated with them. So again, you know, this was a case of why it's vital, I think, to get out into the field and look into these reports personally, because, you know, people can argue forever and a day as to whether or not this was relevant, but on the other hand, we would never have found this evidence, if that's what it was, without actually getting out there. But it was kind of strange, you know, to be on this sort of spooky, isolated island in the middle of this large lake, knowing these strange creatures have been seen, and then to find this clearly man-made or intelligently made pyramid-like structure out of these branches. So, wow. You know, that was sort of a significant, memorable case for me as well. But what's really ironic is that we live on the shores of a place called White Rock Lake in Dallas, which is a 9 mile round lake, you know, in a wooded area of Dallas. And even White Rock Lake has its own goatman legend that goes back years. But again, in this case, there's no way that something like this could live so close to Dallas. And certainly a number of the people who've said they've seen it over here have described it as almost like a phantom spectral type creature, which again, you know, it's arguable whether it actually falls into the category of cryptozoology or, you know, sort of ghost hunting even, I guess.
Yeah. And on that note, we need to take our last break.
Alrighty.
This should be a quick one, so
Okay. Don't
anybody go too far. I've got a whole slew of questions that popped up in my head about the goat man while
Okay. You
were talking, so I'm hoping I can remember all of them. This is Through the Keyhole. I'm your host, Karen Dolan, and my guest today is Nick Redfern, author of Memoirs of a Monster Hunter, among many, many other really fantastic books. But he's telling us about his latest book right now. So we're going to take a very quick break, and we'll be right back. Hi, everyone. Welcome back to Through the Keyhole on ParanormalRadioNetwork.com. I'm your host, Karen Dolan, and we're here for our last segment of the show, talking with Nick Redfern, author of Memoirs of a Monster Hunter. And we've been talking about quite a lot of his investigations into various types of legendary creatures that he's finding out are real. I can't wait to read the book myself. We talked about werewolves. We talked about the Loch Ness Monster, Mothman. We've been talking about chupacabras, and now we're on to the Goatman of Texas. There were a couple of things I wanted to ask you about, mm-hmm. Nick. One was about the Goatman. What does it do? I mean, is this something that's just been sighted? Is it known to attack animals or people?
Well, what's interesting, Karen, about the Goatman is that there aren't really attacks on people or even animals. However, the creature itself, people have said that when they've seen it, in, for example, you know, the immediate, maybe 30 seconds to a minute before they saw it, they felt that, you know, particularly if they're out in the woods, they felt that things weren't quite right, but in a way they couldn't describe. It was almost as if they knew something was watching them, and they had this kind of feeling of dread and panic come over them. Now, what's interesting about that is that one of the classic Goatmen legends, if you like, that goes back, you know, right back to the start of mythology, is that of Pan, the legendary folkloric character Pan. And actually that's where we get the term panic from, is from the god Pan, with this cloven-hoofed creature. So it's interesting that, you know, thousands of years ago, ancient man viewed this cloven-hoofed character called Pan as being associated with panic, where we get the word from. And today, people who see this thing very often have said that they had this feeling of dread come over them before the creature actually appeared. So, you know, it's like, which came first, the legend, or is the legend based on a reality? You know,
yeah, it almost sounds like that's where the word came from, because people were already feeling it.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And, you know, I think, again, it's open to question as to, in some of these cases, if we are dealing with flesh and blood animals, or we're dealing with something that, you know, is pretty much unresolvable, because it's not a flesh and blood creature. Certainly, I think some of the creatures, you know, I've looked into are flesh and blood. I think, for the most part, I think the chupacabras is. Bigfoot and the, you know, things like the abominable snowman, the Himalayan cousin, and China's Yeren, and the Almasti in Russia, all of these, you know, hair-covered wild men-type creatures inhabiting equally wild locations. And, for example, in China, up to 500,000 years ago, there was a huge ape that used to roam that area called Gigantopithecus, which is literally a huge creature that would, you know, dwarf the mountain gorilla or the silverback gorilla, you know, that we know of today. So, you know, some people have said, is it possible that the Yeti in particular and China's Yeren could be the modern-day equivalent, you know, the descendant of Gigantopithecus? And I think that is probably quite likely. You know, we're dealing there with more flesh and blood physical creatures that, you know, could well be on a, you know, evolutionary downslide, not too many of them left, but I think that probably answers what Bigfoot is. But some of them, you know, like the Mothman, as I said, seem sort of really beyond weird, shall we say.
Now, what do you see is the relationship between the Goatman and Bigfoot?
Well, that's the interesting thing, is that I'm not entirely sure if there actually is a direct relationship. I mean, with the Lake Worth reports, for example, we're faced with one of two scenarios. One is that people saw a Goatman-type creature and a Bigfoot, and, you know, the Bigfoot-type creature was also responsible for these weird formations we found. But then again, you have to say, well, is it possible that two unknown creatures could inhabit one particular area? And that doesn't seem likely. You know, I'll be truthful, I don't really have an answer for that. You know, I just don't know. All I can sort of do is say, pay this is what we found. We spoke to some people who reported this goatman-type creature, but we found formations that seem more associated with Bigfoot-type animals. So, you know, often, unfortunately, we look into one mystery and it ends up giving us two or three more mysteries rather than, you know, answering the original one. And I think, you know, a lot of aspects of the paranormal and people investigate them can probably appreciate that.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes you delve into something and you end up with more questions than answers.
Oh, always. That's when you can tell you've really, you got a good lead.
Yeah.
You come up with more questions.
Yeah.
I can understand how you feel like when you're investigating one area, I can understand feeling that, okay, I can accept maybe that there's Bigfoot here, there's one creature here. But saying that there are two unknown creatures in one area almost feels like it's pushing it. On the other hand, if you found an area where one creature is able to live undetected, maybe that is also a good area, you know, a good place for someone else to hide as well.
Well, I think also, you know, it depends how isolated and unexplored the area is. I mean, I'll give you a good example. A friend of mine, Richard Freeman. Richard is a professional zoologist, and he's a resident zoologist at an organization I also work for, which is based in Britain, called the Center for Fortean Zoology, named after Charles Fort. And I run the US office, and Richard and a couple of colleagues are going to Guyana in, I think it's about 10 days' time, for 2 weeks, because there have been reports of several, literally over the centuries, from the local tribes, reports of three strange creatures. One which is known as the Didi, which is basically described as like your typical hairy wild man. There's one which is described as like a very vicious water lake monster type creature. And then there are also reports of giant anaconda snakes. Now again, people might wonder, well, you know, why are the three such strange animals or out of the ordinary animals in one location? But then again, the place where these creatures have been seen, which is known as Monkey Mountain, and the surrounding areas, actually isn't that well travelled or investigated, and it's remained unchanged for years and years. There haven't been many people exploring it and going there to have a look around. So it isn't impossible that, you know, the wildlife, the temperature, the geography, everything else hasn't really changed for thousands of years. So, you know, it's not implausible that in untouched areas you would find creatures that, you know, we haven't seen before. So I think, you know, that's a possibility.
What part of the world is this?
This is Guyana.
Oh, okay.
And they're going out there in 2 weeks' time, just under 2 weeks' time, for 2 weeks. And we try and, Centre for Fortean Zoology, we try and do about three or four expeditions a year. And, it's kind of tough because it's all self-funded. But, I mean, in the last 2 years, we've done one trip to Mongolia looking for this strange creature called the death worm, which is described as being 2 to 4 feet in length and supposedly lives under the sands of Mongolia, yet it can reportedly disable and kill its prey with an electric shock like an electric eel would. And supposedly can transfer it through the sand almost. And that's the legend that the local villages and tribesmen in Mongolia talk about. So we did that one. We went to Thailand looking for a creature called the Naga, which is described as being like a huge monstrous snake. A lot of English-based expeditions, and now, as I said, this one to Guyana. And next year, we're hoping to do one to the Caucasus, the Caucasus Mountains in Russia, in search of the Russian version of the Yeti. So that should be a good one.
What's the Russian version called?
Well, that's called the Almasty, or the Almas, as some people talk about it. And there are a lot of theories as to what this creature might be. In some cases, it's being described as like a completely hair-covered animal, very much like the Bigfoot. Others have described it as being semi-hair covered and looking semi-human. And there have actually been some studies done which kind of suggest, although it's controversial, that these might be surviving pockets in the very, very remote areas of Russia, of surviving pockets of Neanderthal man, almost like a caveman rather than an ape man. That's a possibility. And interestingly enough, from some of the same locations and in some of the really remote parts of Siberia, not only do we get reports of these Neanderthal type creatures, but there are a number of reports going back to the latest maybe in the 1950s of people describing seeing hairy elephants, which sound very much like mammoths almost.
Yeah.
There was one actually by two Russian military pilots flying over Siberia in the Second World War, and they said they saw a couple of these what looked like giant hairy elephants just roaming the Siberian wastelands. So, you know, people I think today imagine that we know every area of the world, you know, every aspect of the countries, etc. And we actually don't. You know, a lot of places remain vastly underexplored or completely unexplored. So, again, you just don't really know what's out there. You know, I think in today's internet world, we think we know it all. We actually don't.
That's true. With having access to the internet, it's easy just to sit at home and do a search on whatever and come up with so much information that you don't go there and you don't see these large areas where really nobody can tell you what's there.
And I think the unfortunate thing that a lot of people forget as well is that mainstream science, for example, you know, is very worried about its reputations, and so you won't get mainstream scientists going after Bigfoot or trekking through the South American jungles for a month. Equally, you know, the media tends to poke fun at all these things, whether it's Bigfoot or UFOs. You know, they just deride it and make fun of it. So it's left to those of us that have personal interests to do that. But, you know, for the most part, we're not millionaires, you know, with money coming out of our ears and our pockets constantly. So we're forced to self-fund investigations, and you know, yes, we've got the dedication, but we may not have, you know, the money to go to some of the places where, if we're able to sort of, you know, go there for a month, 2 months at a time, we could actually get some answers, because, you know, we all have to put food on the table as well.
Right.
And I think that's one of the downsides a lot of people don't realize, or, you know, don't appreciate or forget, is that if we were had unlimited funding to do some of these things, I'm pretty sure, whether it's UFOs or cryptozoology, we would stand a good chance of solving them if we had dedicated teams of people with, you know, viable funding, etc., to where we could go out there with unlimited resources and, you know, do a major investigation, rather than the sort of things we're largely limited to, which is a week here or a week there and hoping for the best. And yes, coming up with some good material, but not necessarily resolving things.
Right. Well, to be fair, mainstream science is, I mean, if we all worked in mainstream science doing research and development, we'd have unlimited money, but we still wouldn't be able to study things unknown and really find new information. What we'd be allowed to do is perform tests that confirm the conclusion that the guy paying the bills wants us to.
Yes. Yeah, and I think, you know, that's one of the unfortunate aspects of mainstream science today. It's almost as if that classic 19th century explorer gung-ho type character has gone from science, and it's been replaced by the guy who's worried about where his next grant's coming from, I think.
Have those of us who aren't worried about where our next grant is coming from, but, you know, we don't have the resources.
No, that's right. I mean, you know, unless you happen to win the lottery tomorrow, certainly, you know, I'm not going to be in a position to sort of take 2 weeks off away from home just to go trekking around the woods.
Right.
You know, when I'm able to, I will. But, you know, if we had teams of people who could do that week in, week out, you know, this team goes 1 week and then they're replaced by another team and another team, that I think would resolve
things. That's the real reason why we're all interested in studying the paranormal. We're all trying to figure out how to find those lottery numbers. That's what I'm in it for. I mean, everybody, you know, people always say, oh, all these UFO abductees writing stories and, you know, writing their books and telling their stories, they're just in it for the money.
Mm.
No.
No, they're not. I'd like to know where it is.
I'm into the paranormal thing for the money. Yeah, I want to find those.
I think, you know, I mean, don't get me wrong, I enjoy what I do, and I'm very pleased and appreciative of the fact that I don't have to have a 9-to-5 job, somebody telling me, you know, move this box or do that, and getting stuck in traffic jams every day. But, you know, the sacrifice is that, you know, you live frugally. And, you know, I'm not complaining about it, because I'd sooner do something I enjoy than be miserable, frankly.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I'd rather be poor and happy than miserable and rich. So.
I like having a really old car that's paid for.
Yeah.
I'm okay with that.
Yeah, that's right. As long as it goes, that's the main thing.
That's
I don't have to worry about keeping up with the neighbors and buying a new one each year. I'm not bothered about that at all.
No, but see, you want to be able to travel.
Yeah.
You need to be able to come up with the money to go to Puerto Rico and study these things, or go to Mongolia and look for the death worm. That is so cool.
Yeah, I think that's sort of, you know, if you've got an inquiry in mind, you should follow it. I wish that there was a way in which we would have whole teams of people where we were funded and we could actually yes, you know, this person A isn't obviously going to be there for an entire year, but person A after 10 days could be replaced by the B team and then the C team. You know, I think it's something like Roswell as well. You know, if there was a whole range of people, even if they didn't agree on Roswell, for example, but if you've got 10 people and, you know, for the first month, the first, you know, three of those people go out and travel around the US to different archives and track down old people who were at Roswell, then after 3 weeks they get replaced by Team B, and it, you know, it continues on and on. I think then we would have a good chance of solving things, but it is, you know, we're just limited by the fact that people have to have jobs, have to earn money,
right,
and people just aren't able to, you know, put in the necessary spade work that's required.
And there are a few, see, we need to get entertainers and actors into this, because they're the ones who have all the money.
Well, that's true, yeah.
And they've got more than they know what to do with. What is, Jerry Seinfeld had 26 cars?
Yes.
I mean, he collects them.
Mm.
And if you have the money, okay, fine, you've got to do something with it. So why doesn't he fund an expedition to go, you know, find out what happened in Roswell?
Yeah, I think, you know, joking aside, that would be good if there's somebody who, you know, listening, who could say, hey, you know, I've got a big interest in this mystery or that mystery. That is the way to solve it, I think.
Yeah.
Otherwise, we're just, you know, picking up on little threads here and there and just trying to do, you know, a few days investigations here and there. And that doesn't mean we won't solve it that way. I just think it's just an incredibly long and drawn-out process to get to the bottom of it. And, you know, of course, it's like with Roswell. The further and longer time goes on, the less and less people are still alive. You know, the less chance of finding files. And, you know, eventually it becomes, you know, I mentioned this before, things like Roswell, although it's off-topic with cryptozoology, I think Roswell's in danger of becoming like an American equivalent of Britain's Jack the Ripper, in the sense it's an ancient mystery that attracts a lot of interest, but it's so long ago, the chances of actually solving it get thinner and slimmer every year.
Right. Well, there was another thing I wanted to ask you about the goat man. Mm. Talk about this being is supposed to have cloven hooves, and I wanted to know if there's any connection between that and the Spring-Heeled Jack.
Well, you know, that's a good question. There hasn't necessarily been a connection in the sense that people have said that there's a connection because the creatures or the beings look similar. It's often, though, that in England, for example, there are reports. For example, there was one in the southwest of England, a very famous one, the Devil's Footprints, which ties in with the Goatman sightings and Spring-Heeled Jack, of this, you know, this weird creature that leaves unusual prints. And again, you know, it parallels the fact that lots of cultures have these winged creatures and hairy man creatures and lake monsters and, you know, these cloven-hoofed beings, you know, that leave weird footprints and sort of bound throughout the trees, and like Spring-Heeled Jack sort of, you know, was seen jumping through the alleyways around London, this dark cloaked figure. You know, there are parallels and connections between these things. You know, yes, they seem to have their own cultural differences, but you know, at the core of it, there seem to be several, as I said at the beginning, archetypes that we can place a lot of these creatures into.
Right. There's just so much. I'm just amazed. In the 2 hours, we've only talked about this one book, and look at how much we've covered. And just touched on so many areas that I'd love to get back into.
Well, I mean, you know, for this book alone, I cover everything, as I said, not just, you know, the Chupacabras, the Goat Man, but gargoyle reports, Bigfoot sightings, hairy wild men, which seem, you know, more like wild men, giant snakes, giant eels, lake monsters. You know, it pretty much covers the whole range of what you would expect, you know, to fall into the field of cryptozoology. And certain, some cases, you know, are less well investigated because we just don't have many facts to go on. Others, you know, like the Bigfoot legend, are far more extensive, shall we say. But, you know, I guess from my perspective, you know, as I said earlier, that I think it's vital to get out there and to have the, I guess, the impetus and, you know, the dedication, obviously, but also the enthusiasm. I think that's one of the most important things with, like, cryptozoology. You need the enthusiasm to get out there and be willing to spend time and get your hands dirty in the woods, because that is really the only way we're going to solve a lot of these cases. You know, UFOs to an extent, you can go to archives, go through government documents, things like that. But cryptozoology doesn't really have its equivalent. There is no sort of real excuse or approach you can take beyond, you know, sort of trekking through the locations, which, you know, I enjoy doing, so that's a good thing.
and lucky for us that there are people like you who go out there and do that and out this information.
Yeah, and not
write
the sort
books
of
on
just...
it so the rest of us can look at it and say, oh, wait, that case sounds like this other one I read.
Yeah, I mean, not to dumb
country.
The subject down, but, I mean, you know, as well, it's good fun to do it as well. It's fun to get out there and do these investigations.
And for those of us who aren't able to travel all over the world, I would love to. I'd love to travel more, but,
Well, as I said, you know, it is one of these things. Sometimes you have the benefits and the good luck, like when I went with Paul, that you're going, you know, on with a film crew, you know, who fly you out there and whatever. There are other occasions, you know, where you're just completely self-funding and you think, whoa, you know, am I going to pay next week's electric bill or whatever?
Exactly.
that can be a factor.
And that's when we start off by going and getting your books. You get a basic primer course.
So, you know, as I said, it's something I enjoy doing. I think, you know, I've tried to answer a lot of questions and or highlight, you know, a lot of these cases, and I think... Mm-hmm. We are on the right track in terms of where we're looking and what we're looking for. And I think, unfortunately, a lot of these things there may not be many of them left, you know, and it becomes harder and harder to find them. And some things I'm quite sure that were people looking for 30, 40 years ago, they may be gone today. I mean, certainly the number of reports of Loch Ness Monster that are made today are vastly down on what they were in the 40s and the 50s. You know, maybe in a worst-case scenario, the creatures will become extinct before we actually prove what they were. You know, that would be a tragedy, but, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if in some cases that didn't actually happen.
Yeah. Well, and here I was hoping they were just responding to the increased activity of humans around the lock.
I mean, I think that has something to do with it, and, you know, that wouldn't surprise me at all. You know, I think it's just an issue to be concerned about, the fact that, you know, maybe that explains part of it, but it could also be explained by there's just not many left. You know, we're polluting their environments. You know, we're in their environment more. We're catching fish in their environments. Some of the forests are being chopped down and cut, and, you know, that all takes its toll on the known animals. You know, you only have to look at things like the giant panda, tigers, lions, elephants. They're all on the endangered list.
Yeah.
You know, so why shouldn't an unknown animal that... We may not have found it, but if it inhabits the same areas, that might be on the endangered list as well. So.
Right. Well, and on that note, we're going to have to end it. I cannot believe we've reached the end of 2 hours already.
Yeah, gone fast. It's like missing time.
Yeah, I know. Oh, boy. That's another whole topic. Nick, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Oh, sure. I've enjoyed it, Karen. Thanks for having me on.
Great. I have just really enjoyed talking with you
about this,
and I can't wait to read your book.
Okay, well, make sure hopefully it should be with you in a few days.
Yeah, and everybody who's listening, definitely go out and get a copy of this book, Nick Redfern's Memoirs of a Monster Hunter. Sounds like a fantastic read. I've read some of Nick's other books, and they are terrific. So, thanks everyone for joining us. Thank you again, Nick.
Sure, no problem at all.
This has been Through the Keyhole on Paranormal Radio Network. I'm your host, Karen Dolan, and our guest has been Nick Redfern. Come to our website and get some more information about his book and enjoy it. And everybody have a happy and safe Halloween, okay? See you next week.